This is CliffCentral.com.
Well, here she is. She's one of the most dynamic people in South Africa. She has done incredible things in television. She's achieved a huge amount in business. She's someone a lot of people in this country look up to. And I'm delighted to finally sit down and talk to her after a long time. And we've known each other for years. But the beautiful, the talented, the amazingly entrepreneurial Basitsane Khumalo.
Hey. How are you, my brother? It's been a very long time. Thank you for having me, Gary.
I'm really happy to see you.
And such a wonderful, warm welcome. Thank you, my friend. Appreciate that.
You know, you feel like, and when you when I heard you were coming in, it was almost like we were preparing for royalty. No, I'll explain. I mean, no, seriously. People know that you, the things that you've done in your life, the things you represent, and the road that you've traveled since all those years ago when you were 16, winning like the first Miss Black South Africa at that stage, to the businesses that you've created, the opportunities you've afforded other young women, it appears to me that people hold you in very, very high esteem, even if they don't know that much about you. They're like, oh, wow, Bussy.
Gareth, I mean, I think South Africans are very generous in spirit. South Africans are a giving people, and when they embrace you into their heart, into their space, it's very heartwarming. I grew up on stage, in essence. I mean, you and I grew up in the broadcasting space, so we've known each other since we're pickaninnies. and so having grown up in this glass bowl, in essence. You refer to Miss Black South Africa when I was 16. My mother, you know, the wisdom of an older woman got us involved into these, you know, beauty pageants to try and keep us off the streets. I've got two elder sisters and one younger brother. And it was not necessarily because I woke up one day when I was, you know, pre-teens and looked at myself in the mirror and said, I'm going to be a Miss so-and-so. I think to a large degree, it was, of course, a means to an end as well. And I'll tell you a story. My mom was a teacher by profession. My dad was a bus driver. And you know, when you were entering some competition in the hood, right, you'd win. I remember my sister Johanna entered Miss Ellerine's. She won like a fridge. My sister Auslerato, who's a teacher, entered Miss King Kong. I think she won a two-plate stove. And then when I entered Miss Black South Africa, I won this beautiful leather suite, black and lounge leather suite, which is still in my mother's house. So sure. I think my mother decided these girls are going to furnish my home. And and so when you were not doing
well, with
that,
the amount of work she put in, it was maybe some time for you guys to give something back.
You know what I mean? Her and Papa had to obviously make sure there was food on the table, clothes on our back, a roof over our heads. So I grew up in a very secure home where we believed that we mattered. And so when your parents believe the best of you and say, you're going to go out there and enter this competition or that competition, being the youth choir, the Sunday school, the youth camp. So we were very busy, my siblings and I, and the entrepreneurial streak in me runs in my DNA because I had watched my parents, even though they had the 8 to 5, but outside of work, they had to really supplement the family income. We did, weekends, we were selling ichisa nyama at Osaka Stadium, sandwiches. When other kids were playing in the schoolyard, my mom used to give me a bag of lollipops. I used to sell those. So I started to work with money from an early age, at the age of 6. And I think, you know, just think about I think it's Robert Kiyosaki who wrote a book, Rich Dad, Poor Dad. He advocates that teach your children to work with money from an early age. And so, you know, my parents started a construction company in the hood when a policeman or a nurse or a social worker or a teacher made a bit of money. They would have to they would extend their homes.
Right. Do additions.
Additions, etc. So my parents read the market. You know, they had a market analysis. So they started this construction company. So all I know is just to be self-employed. And as I said, the entrepreneur that I am today, 23 years later, is because I gleaned it from my mother's kitchen, from my mother's bosom, watching my father and my mother work as a team.
But you know, that's such a special thing because it isn't the rule, it's the exception. unfortunately, for so many kids, particularly here in South Africa. We don't have strong nuclear families. We don't have parents who stay together. We don't have parents who set the right example for various reasons. I mean, we all know that the history of this country is pockmarked with
the migrations,
injustices,
the
and absolutely
metropolises.
But to have had both your parents there, to have had the role models that you had growing up, that imbued you with an unbelievable self-confidence. All of you in the family.
It was the best upbringing one could have had.
Because that's worth more than money. Than a big house or a car or a great school or any of these things that we think are so important raising kids today.
And that sense of security that we were raised with made us believe that we could do anything, we could become anything, that we were good enough. My dad, every single day, would affirm us, would say, baby girl, you're destined for greatness. And so to really have had that primary upbringing. I mean, I remember, Gareth, when I was 13, my dad gave me my first book by Norman Vincent Peale, The Power of Positive Thinking. So I grew up in an environment where I knew that my voice mattered. And it really has held us in good stead, my sisters and I, and my younger brother, who's an IT boffin. I mean, he cracks systems.
I'm amazed also because at that stage, being black and being a woman, your work was cut out for you. I mean, you'd have to do twice as much and go twice as far to get half. And your father never let you believe that you were anything less than brilliant.
Absolutely.
Any of you, right?
Any of us.
I mean, that's just, what an insightful man this guy was.
Now, we call him Brafil. He was the sharpest, smartest dresser in the hood, I got to tell you that. Even when he had retired for 30 years, my dad would get up in the morning, wear his three-piece suit, put on his dops, and then he had these Floshim shoes, always shining. He says, baby girl, the world is a stage. When you step out of my home, look your best. People are attracted to those who glow, and you glow. You've got it in you. And so when you have a primary role model who instills that sense of self-belief and worth, it really lays a foundation and a platform for you to then step to greater things. I mean, Papa, as a bus driver, was a ferocious reader. So I have a collection of books from him. When he passed on, there were just these books that I really wanted to, you know, to keep from him when my siblings and I had to decide what of his legacy we wanted to keep. And that instilled my love for reading. That instilled my passion for people. But also coming, you know, I mean, and you're quite right. One, having grown up in an apartheid system, the child of the 70s, being a black girl child, being disadvantaged. So when you're triple disadvantaged, you're black, you're a child, you're a girl,
and you're poor.
And so one had to really work so hard to be able to pull oneself by the bootstraps to come out of that situation and environment and write a new narrative of what a black girl child can achieve.
You know, this is what's so complicated about humans. We all have such individual stories, and obviously nobody's story applies to everyone else. But in your case, you know, it was what was put into your head that made the difference when you were so young. And I suppose it bears out in all four of the children of this incredible couple, because so many other kids have things or have what they think are advantages, and they don't get that going. They don't manage to break out of that mentality. They don't manage to forge ahead. And for various reasons, again, you know, we don't want to sound like we know all the answers.
Nobody does.
Sure.
Nobody does.
But you wouldn't swap that for any, you wouldn't have swapped your parents for any other parents in the
Gareth,
world.
Gareth, my mother was a strong, formidable Xhosa matriarch. My mother never suffered fools. Being a teacher, her word was final. When she said jump, child, you said how high, ma'am. You didn't debate anything that, you know, my mother had to put forward. I mean, my mother would slap you with a wet dishcloth. that wooden spoon that she was making the pup, you better be ducking and diving if you even thought you had the right to back chat. The slippers,
a mom of the 70s.
Do you know what I mean?
I got you.
She just was very clear that she wanted these kids to be decent members of society. So she was a disciplinarian in our home. My dad was the softy. If we all got into trouble, just run to my dad. And he'd give us Tofalux sweets. He says, no, don't run about your mom. She'll come around. And so having been raised by God-fearing parents, we were instilled with the Christian value system very, very early on in our lives when we were born.
If I can't see you misbehaving, someone else is.
Do you know? Yeah. But I wouldn't trade my upbringing for anything because, you know, I suppose in that space at that time, you think it's so unfair. Other kids are playing the streets. They're playing hide and seek. Mm-hmm. During the school breaks, you still had to slog to help the family to supplement its income. But of course, hindsight is the best science. And I look back upon my life and say, thank God I was raised in that home, with formidable beings, larger than life. And you're right. I mean, the challenges we're having in our country is that our families have become fragmented. You know, it's so sad today that children are raising children.
Yeah.
The child headed households, the scourge of HIV/AIDS has caused so much destruction in society. Of course, we know the migration, you know, the fathers coming to the city of gold,
yeah,
to mine the gold. And so for me, I'm a firm believer that it takes a village to raise a child. And that's the ethos that we were raised in the neighborhood, that you were everybody's child. If you were caught doing something or stealing at the shop, at the general dealer, any mother in the hood had absolutely every right to give you a hiding. Every mother or father in the child, if they saw you standing in the street corner with some boy.
What are you doing?
So it took a village to raise all of us in the hood. And I really want, you know, to wake up to a country where we go back to that essence of Ubuntu, where we raise each other's children. And even though, you know, there's challenges that we're facing of children raising children, but there's many of us out there who can make a contribution.
Did your father get to see your incredible success?
My father got to see my name being announced in 1994 as Miss South Africa. A new dispensation, new democracy, new government. And I remember in Sun City, when my name was called, both my parents, my siblings, extended family were there. My father never used to share a tear. And I distinctly remember after, you know, the crowning, there was the coronation ball, and my father looked me in the eye and said, "You did good, child. You did good." And he shed a tear. And so the journey of my life, which Miss South Africa catapulted me to a national platform, was, you know, it gave them an opportunity to see what they had instilled in my siblings and I. I started to present top billing, so I used to travel with my dad overseas. I loved hanging out with him. Me and him, you know, we're thick as thieves. So he got to see part of my successes. He rested in 2003. And one of the things that I'm also very grateful for is that my dad at least managed to walk me down the aisle in 2000 when I got married. And I still believe that he watches. He's not here in the physical, but in the spirit.
Sees his grandchildren.
He sees his grandchildren who he never got to meet. And if, you know, it's one thing that perhaps, you know, makes me sad is probably, you know, that he never got to see his grandchildren.
That Miss South Africa crowning. I mean, I know you this is a long time ago, and it's been a part of your life that you're by no means tired of talking about because it meant so much, not just to you. I mean, I remember being, you know, a kid who was trying to understand what our country was going through. And there was this beautiful and dignified young black woman on TV who was showing us the best of what we could all be and like what this future could mean. And it's symbolic, right? It's not, I didn't know you. I didn't know anything about you. I just saw you as this presence. And it was to me a very powerful an opportunity for us to kind of do something that would elevate the whole country. Because there was so much going on at that stage that was fraught with confusion and aggression and danger. And I mean, we just emerged from horrible, what, 40 years, 50 years of just second-class citizens and first-class citizens. Mm-hmm. And the first-class citizens didn't even know they were first-class, but they certainly knew the others were second. And the second-class citizens didn't know what first-class might have felt like, but they knew they were second. And then you were there, and you just shattered so many things about those preconceptions. Even if you, at a young age, weren't aware of it, symbolically looking back now, for so many people, you might have represented a lot more than the politicians.
Wow, that's powerful what you've just said there, Gareth. I think perhaps I represented a sense of hope to a new nation. I was embraced by all races when I was crowned Miss South Africa. I'd like to believe that I was a representation of what this rainbow nation we're trying to build potentially looks like. And I think for the black girl child in Soweto and Kukuletu, in Mamelodi, when they saw me and my crowning and what being an ambassador of the new South Africa meant, it meant that they too can.
Right.
They too have the opportunity to be able to realize their dreams and
you won't be left out anymore.
You won't be left out anymore. You also belong at the table.
Right.
You've earned your place in the sun.
Yeah.
To be heard, to be seen. So I'd like to believe that I opened up a whole new paradigm for black excellence.
Yep.
And what, you know, black people can achieve. But equally so, the way I was embraced by all races was very, very heartwarming.
Well, a lot of Afrikaans white people, Miss South Africa was more important than anything else in the world. I mean, it was a big deal, you know, that there's still like Miss Krugersdorp still talks about being Miss Krugersdorp, you know. So this, and here was this black woman who had risen to the top and who'd been chosen by the judges in the whole of South Africa as the embodiment of what feminine beauty and elegance and grace and all of these things would be going forward. And I think for a lot of them, that was also a watershed moment of, oh, wow, we've been lied to about, you know, these fellow countrymen of ours. They can't be and aren't going to be able to ascend to the great heights that we value, like, you know, Miss South Africa. And I know a lot of people think beauty pageants are stupid, but it's like elections. People can argue those are stupid. It's just a popularity contest. Mm. And people could argue that the stock markets are stupid because it's all based on sentiment. But all of these things are what make the world go round.
You've hit it on the nail. You know, for me, Miss South Africa as a pageant, for example, afforded me a platform that I potentially would have never had. I always say that people are gifted with many different talents. People are athletically gifted. People are gifted with numbers. They become accountants. People get given an opportunity to shine on a stage. But also it's what you do with that that matters. What I was very clear about was that when I won Miss South Africa, it was only going to be a 12-month reign. What was important for me was what I was going to do with my life post the 12 months. So understanding that this platform is so influential, perhaps even more powerful, or powerful to some degree.
Sure, you got to meet everybody and anybody.
I was traveling with the Madibas of the world.
And we were the flavor of the world at that
stage.
We
were on the world stage.
Nobody would have said no to an invitation to or from South Africa, right?
Correct.
So you would have flown to embassies in every part of the world. You would have met presidents, kings, queens, emperors.
Making speeches as a 20-year-old.
I mean, what an introduction to the world.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you had the confidence to carry that off because you came at a golden time and you were the golden person at that time. So again, you know, a lot of people win beauty pageants, a lot of people win Miss South Africa. And a lot of these girls might, for various reasons, not have the opportunities that you did, or maybe they have more. But the fact was, like, that was the sweet spot, 1994. Couldn't have been better, right?
It could not have been better. It was a turning point for me. I had to grow up very fast, though. At 20, I was doing my third year at the University of Venda, studying towards a teacher's degree. And so, you know, at 20, I'm traveling with Madiba. I'm preceding before he makes his speech, introducing him. At 20, I'm interviewed by international media, CNN, BBC, because, of course, it's 1994. Mm. So South Africa is but on stage. But my friends at the time were, you know, clubbing, dancing on tables. So I had to grow up very quickly and understand the hour that was bestowed upon me and decide at that very time what I was going to do with that moment in time, because it would be fleeting.
Were you always so focused?
I've always had a sense of direction, I think, to some degree. And I also have to, you know, give kudos to my parents, because I think it has a lot to do with how I was raised. And our lives were structured. If you were, you know, out of school, this is what you were doing. You're going to sell your tray of eggs up and down the street. And then from there, you'll come and, you know, do your homework. And so there was, so it was very structured.
What I'm asking is, because you said just now you had a plan for after Miss South Africa.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that's that most 20-year-olds don't have a plan for tomorrow, let alone for Miss South Africa.
I journal a lot. So when I won, the title, I wrote my short-term goals, medium-term goals, and long-term goals that I wanted to achieve.
Wow.
And my short-term goal, Gareth, was as basic as getting a driver's license. I want a car. I didn't have a driver's license. I'm a 20-year-old. My medium-term goal was to travel and see the world. I had never been on a plane when I won Miss South Africa. The furthest I'd been out of Soweto was to Durban with my siblings on my father's bucky. At the back, it put a mattress and packed us like sardines. Uh-huh. We had the dombolo and the, oh man, my mother used to make this chicken, you know, that my bizango was Xhosa umleqo, the chicken that red. I mean, it's a bad translation, right? And so my long-term goal, I wanted to be my own boss. I had a clear understanding that I never wanted to work for anybody. I never wanted to wake up and say, good morning, sir, or good morning, madam. So the short-term goal, I ticked it off very quickly, got the driver's license. My dad taught me how to drive. Medium-term goal, this travel, because I already put it out there into the universe. I believe that it responded through Top Billing. And I got to travel the world 5, 7, 8 passports later. And long-term, of course, I'm creating jobs. I employ 200 people, connect another 200, a travel flair. My sister and I employ 850 people. In my money business, I employ a few thousand people. My property business. So all of that I put out, even though I didn't quite know how I was going to get there.
Yeah.
But I had a sense of, I had the vision. And as a believer, it says in the book of Habakkuk, make your tablets known on petition. So I did write my vision on this piece of paper. And so talking about it, we have always been structured. I'd like to believe I've always had some sense of direction, even though I didn't have the crystal ball to say how it's going to pan out.
And massive drive, like just massive drive.
I have a zeal for life. I love life, and I think life loves me back. I am passionate about what I do.
I meet people all the time and they go, I feel like I've got enough. And I don't understand that. Like, I think you can have it all. I really think you can. Like, you can be a good person. You can have a great family life. You can run a successful business. You can have meaningful relationships. You can have it all, right?
It's a balancing act, I think.
But you don't think when things are good, and really a lot of your life has been good, and you've made a lot of that happen. It hasn't just happened. But you don't ever, because you get these people who feel that they've lucked out and that their luck's going to run out. You don't ever feel like that.
I think I'm an eternal optimist. I firmly believe that if you ever woke up one day in life and think that you have arrived, that's going to be a very sad day. It's a day when one will stop growing. It's a day when one will stop thriving. And, you know, we all are a work in progress. So every day is about striving to do better than what one did yesterday. And so complacency, it's not in my vocab. Also mediocrity. I just subscribe to that. Even with, you know, the people, I always say that people work with me. People don't work for me.
Right.
So in understanding the responsibility, because, you know, I always believe that to whom much is given, much is expected. And therefore I cannot afford to, you know, rest on my laurels.
No.
I don't have a trust fund. I don't have share certificates that my parents left in the bank vault. I have a responsibility to create a generational legacy, not only with my nuclear family, but with a generation of South African children, young people.
Well, I know you've done that. And I actually have some people I want to ask you about, because you haven't just been a role model at a distance to some people. You've got involved in their lives and helped them in very obvious and very direct ways. But I want to save that for just now. You mentioned top billing just a moment ago. Now, when you started off there, you were just a presenter.
Quite right.
And you were smart enough to say, this thing has got the potential of being produced outside of the SABC. At that point, everything was produced in-house.
Quite right, by Henley Studios.
You were the first person who said, I'm going to do this. And as a black woman, I'm going to be the first to do this. And you said, it was you and Patience, right?
Quite right.
And you said to, Zwelakhe Sisulu?
Yeah. You know,
we want to take this show and we want to do it our way, and we'll produce
it. Independent producers.
You pay us to put together a show. We will put together a much better show than what you're getting at the moment.
Give us an opportunity.
That's ballsy. How old were you then?
I was 20.
Yes. 20, so, and I'm going to produce a better show than what you're doing.
So it's 3 months into me being a television presenter, being in front of the camera. And I think my personality is that I get bored very quickly. So after 3 months of regurgitating Beronga's script, I just thought there's got to be more to television than just being in front of the camera. So Patience, who's also a great mentor of mine, we sat down. I said, you know, I want to understand the business of television. Give me the 411. And when she broke it down to me that this is my brainchild, top billing, I went to pitch it to the SABC, and obviously they, you know, take your IP and pay you a stipend. I said, okay, how about perhaps we do this? We start a company. We call it Tswelopele. My father is Tswana, so meaning progress. And then I will make a call to the SABC and set up an appointment with the CEO, Babu Zwelakhe Sisulu, like you rightly say. Let's go and negotiate and see if they will be able to afford us an opportunity to be independent producers. And of course, if anything, at least, you know, when they hear that MSSA has called, at least you might get a return call.
But you see, here's the thing. Like, you knock and someone answers. If you never knock, you never know.
That is
a thing that so many people, they look back and on other people's lives with hindsight, and they go, oh, she's so lucky. But you make your luck, right?
I can't remember who said something to the effect that preparation and opportunity make luck happen,
yes,
or something.
I know that one.
One of those.
I know which one you mean.
But you have to show up. You have to raise your hand.
Right.
You have to make the first step. When the door gets opened, you have to walk in. And then it's incumbent upon you to then be able to use that platform and that opportunity. So when that is, Zwelakhe Sisulu granted us the meeting, I went on my own, zip, to the 27th floor.
Intimidating place, huh?
Oh, my word. Isn't it just? And I remember I didn't have a fancy presentation or fancy business speak. I hadn't been to Harvard or Yale yet. And I thought, okay, that is all. Okay, this is the idea. My name is so-and-so. We'd like you to give us an opportunity. My partner and I, Patience Stevens, so empowerment was a new buzzword. Ne?
Yeah.
So I threw that one in. You need to empower us as women. you know. And I remember he gave a pregnant pause. And then when he finally opened his mouth, he said to me, my child, the future of this country looks bright if young people like you can come and do what you've just done. Needless to say, they took forever to make the decision. But 8 months later, we were granted the opportunity to produce Top Billing as independents.
And that show has been so successful.
Thank you.
I mean, it really has. It's kind of a cultural artifact now.
There's a Top Billing speak, you know.
But people know it. Everybody knows it. And everybody, it's hugely aspirational. It's got massive currency.
Mm.
And even though the SABC has changed a lot over this time, and
we've been through 10 CEOs. This year we celebrate 25 years of Top Billing.
But I would say it's still one of their number one properties.
Oh yes, I mean it generates decent revenue for the broadcaster. It's got good ARs. It's a show that celebrates excellence. Whether it's in the arts, in architecture, in fashion, in design. And it's a show that I'd like to believe showcases that it is possible. Yes, it's aspirational, and we find that our audience is very varied. Are people who perhaps can, through socioeconomic status, can't travel. They say, but through top billing, I've been able to travel in the armchair of my home and see the world. The people that can afford to travel, they have, you know, an opportunity to see what else is out there in the world. And the fact that we are able to reach such a different spectrum of the audience, I think best testament that it's found resonance with people. People aspire to always do better with their lives, whether it's in any creative industry. And so as a creative economy, as a creative platform, I think top billing, obviously, bar from creating the jobs, but it's just showed what South Africa can achieve and South Africans can achieve.
Yeah, you show off the best of us. And sometimes that always irritated me because it wasn't realistic. But you know what? I've realized that that's part of the fantasy that you've got to create for people, because life is hard enough. You don't need TV to make
doom
you more
and
miserable.
Gloom.
Just turn on the news. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
That's not what you were wanting to fill. You wanted to create a new niche.
And that's why it's the longest lifestyle show on South African television. And to be able to have, you know, as I said, gone through 10 CEOs, I'd like to believe that it means that we're meeting and filling a particular need in terms of audience consumption.
And think of the careers you've launched.
Yeah, I mean, those young people who have gone on to do bigger and better things out of the top billing platform have become brand ambassadors for multinationals, international companies. And I always say that, you know, don't fix what's not broken. So it's so formulaic. You know you're going to see a home. You know you're going to see a travel segment. You know you're going to see perhaps a movie segment. You know you're going to see a fashion segment. And the audiences, even when we tried to tweak the show, we would rattle them. They would say,
they know what they want.
They know what they want. Give them what they want. They'll stay with you for 25 years.
Yeah, 25 years. Congrats on that.
I was young and thin, darling, when we started.
you're not looking too terrible, I've got to tell you.
Not too shabby. No, some grey hairs here and there, but it's all right. Very, nothing some dire conflicts.
You look very glamorous. You're even wearing our yellow colours today. And it's all perfectly...
You know, I had to clean up for you, you know?
Perfectly coordinated. Now, I think that we could talk about the other parts of your career. I mean, I'm interested, for example, in what you started with Joanna, because you wanted to start a travel company with her. And you were both on Destiny magazine, I saw, not so long ago.
Yeah, quite right.
Yeah, I mean, that must be a source of great pride that you and your sister can be there at the same time. You're both doing your own thing, but you're doing things together as well.
My sister is extraordinary.
She really is.
I mean, Joe is just in a league of her own. The success of TWF, we're celebrating 21 years this year, is testament to this group CEO called Johanna Mugoki, who is a fearless leader. She's bold, she's courageous, she breaks the mold. The fact that we work together, by the fact that she's my BFF, right? But that we work together and we've built, I'd like to believe, a successful TMC, a travel management company. It's also fed into that travel bug that I had earlier on when I was Miss SA, that I wanted to see the world. And over the years...
That medium-term goal became a whole company.
Do you know what I mean?
I'm on to you.
You present, all right. So, I mean, over the years, we've got our own travel academy where we upskill young people out of the tourism environment. We, you know, integrate them into the space. We've created hundreds of jobs over the years. We've educated a generation of young South Africans. And it's so fulfilling when you know that you're making a tangible difference in people's lives. And we have lots of fun together. My sister and I are crazy together.
Do you fight?
We used to fight a lot in our youth days, because I used to steal her clothes. When she was at Rhodes doing her BCom. I was still at home. Yeah. And so she started saving money from an early age. You know, that's why she became an accountant. And then, so she started buying clothes, her punk clothes, and she'd keep them at home for VAC. Well, I broke into that cupboard and I wore those clothes. By the time she got home, they were all washed out. She beat me up into a pulp. Oh my gosh. I tell you. In the later years, you know, then it's funny because the age gap begins to narrow. And we agree to disagree vociferously in a boardroom. But equally so, we respect each other's strengths and contribution to the business because we have a common value and a common vision of what we're trying to create. So nothing is personal. When we get into the boardroom, it's
business. That's important, huh? Nothing is personal. So many people get caught up in that and then they mess everything up. They throw away massive opportunity because they let it get personal.
Yeah, nothing's personal. It's all about the bottom line, a business that we have built over 21 years, but a business that has a great responsibility to continue to create employment for our people.
Are you still on the board of Love Life?
I'm still on the board of Love Life. I mean, I've served there for 7 to 8 years. And I mean, one has a responsibility to give back. Right. I am on the board of the Nelson Mandela Institute for Rural Education and Development. I've been on that board for 10 years.
Rural Education and Development.
Yeah.
So does that involve kind of going into rural communities and what, helping them understand their property rights, helping them understand what local government can do for them, that kind of thing?
Quite right. That and more. I mean, we're in Bizana. We're in the deep, hard rural of the Eastern Cape currently. And what we have this methodology where we call them the magic classrooms. And those magic classrooms, they give children a tangible understanding of the core subjects from a very early age, the maths, the sciences. We create tactile environments.
Because these are still the people who've been left behind.
Quite right. Right. And obviously structurally, we make sure that kids, of course, they don't now study under the tree and that they have conducive environments for productive learning. And so we live on donor funding with the NMI Institute, we've seen. I mean, we also obviously take the teachers and the pedagogy of what we do there is also taking the teachers and really upskilling them to move into this 21st century of using tablets, of using. So it can't be that only our kids at private schools have the kind of opportunity to learn in the first world manner. So we've really taken that to the rural areas. And we've seen results over the last 10 years. We can track it. The data is there that it's actually working. The methodology we've applied is working.
But Nelson Mandela also, I mean, I'm now going back instead of forward from where we were, but I didn't really get into this. You and Madiba had a very close relationship. And I remember when he died, you were one of the people who everybody was talking to because you were there at the time that he'd just become president. You retained a friendship through most of your life. Most of his life. I mean, that was a very, very special thing.
Wow. I've walked with greatness, with humility personified. I have been at the feet of an extraordinary, extraordinary being. And I remember when I won Miss SM, actually getting goosebumps. I got a call. You know, on the other side, it was Zelda Lachran. She's saying, hi, Asana, the president would like to speak to you. And I'm thinking, yeah, right. That's just such a joke, right? It's not even April. It was in September when I won Miss SA. And I took the call. And indeed, on the other line, it was Madiba saying, congratulations, our queen.
Wow.
We are very proud of you as South Africans. And I want you to come and have lunch with an old man. And I went to meet with Tata, and the rest is history. He's embraced me. He loved me. He deeply cared for many of us. He came to bury my parents. He taught me more than any institution that I've been in the last 23 years has ever taught me. Humility that it will take you far in life. He always used to talk about the collective. You know, when you wanted to laud him about, you know, his contribution to our freedom, he always said, darling, it was always about the collective. I was just deployed to be able to lead this movement, but it was always about the collective. We'll always laud Dada O.R., say that he was my leader. And so, even when I got married, he told me that I must tell Khumalo he must come to him to ask for my hand in marriage from him.
I remember that.
And so it's been such a privilege, an extraordinary privilege to have touched and walked with greatness.
He did have Romeo ask you I mean, ask him for you, right?
Yeah. He made you
do the whole thing.
Yeah, and then Kumala had to go to Houghton, all nervous. Say, but I mean, do I really have to? I said, yeah, as the wedding, it might not happen, honey. You better go and ask the old man for my hand in marriage.
So you and Romeo, I mean, this is also just an incredible story because the two of you have been also a kind of a fixture in South Africa, whether it was socially in the beginning, whether it was from a business point of view down the line. Of course, you've both occupied your own spaces and done so very well.
Thank you.
But as a power couple, I don't know that there are very many people who come close to you two. It just seems like it works. Is it effortless, or do you two also get stuck sometimes?
No, we butt heads. I mean, marriage is no walk in the park. But I married my best friend. I married an extraordinary guy who is grounded.
What kind of a father is he?
Man, he's such a present guy, hey? I mean, he does the homework. He hangs out. Every time I watch him with his kids, I just fall in love with him over and over again. My husband is very straightforward. He's not a great guy. He's a black or white guy in terms of, you know, he just how he lives his life. But as a dad, I mean, with his daughter, Buntle has gotten wrapped around his finger. I mean, we've been together, married for 17 years, together another three, so we've been together for 20 years. And I think in essence, we grew up together.
Yeah.
And we actually raised
each
other. And
you grew, again, that glass bowl that you were talking about, because everything about the two of you was then amplified publicly because you were such well-known people.
Quite right.
How do your kids deal with that? Are they even aware of it?
You know, we've made a conscious decision, first of all, that our kids will never be thrust into this media spotlight. So that's why people don't know what they look like.
Yeah.
You've never seen them on a cover of a magazine. Because these children do not ask to be born to parents who chose a public life. And so we have absolutely every responsibility
and
to protect.
And so many well-known people use their kids as accessories, You've never done that.
Kids with Instagram pages, for what?
Yeah.
And so until they come of age, they can choose their own path and their own direction. But so we made a conscious decision that these kids will live as normal as possible. And I'll tell you.
But your eldest, Nati's 12, right?
Nati's 12. So Nati, I think he was around 7 or 8 or so. He comes home after school. And I think I was on a cover of a magazine, and I think one of the boys, he goes to a boys' school, came with it to school to say, oh, my mom asked me to ask your mom to sign the magazine. So he comes home and he says, mommy, are you famous? It was priceless because
greatest moment.
First 8 years of his life.
Had no idea. I love that.
Are you famous?
Like, I love that.
Why are you asking that, boy? No, so-and-so's mom asked me to ask you to sign her book. But this is you. I said, yeah, okay. Then I began to explain to him that parents have different jobs. So mommy's job, the fact that people see mommy on TV or on a magazine does not make mommy's job any more special than so-and-so's dad, who's a doctor, so-and-so's mom, who's a stay-at-home mom. So we all just are doing what we were called to do. Oh, no, he was cool with it and he carried on with his life and, you keep it simple.
Do you think of your parents a lot when you deal with your kids and you think about how to get over difficult situations or whatever? You think of what your mom and dad would have done?
Yeah, and I think now with Nati being a preteen, you can see that he's trying to push the envelope. There's this, obtuseness where you're like, listen to me. I brought you in and I'll take you out, honey.
That's some of your mom coming through, right?
Do you know what I mean? I can just hear my mother's voice through me. Raising kids, it's not necessarily the easiest thing, but they bring such deep joy and meaning to your life.
Do they know how hard it was for you growing up compared to them?
Oh, yeah. We make it very clear. We take them, home, back home, so they can understand, our upbringing, where we come from. I mean, Khosi, for example, he's 5. So during the school holidays, they go to Romeo's parents in Don Park in the east. The first time he arrived, you know, when he was a bit, you know, I think it was around 3 or 4. So he gets to Gogo's house, says, Gogo, your house is nice. I love it. But why is it small? And then I called him to order so quickly. I was about to slap the boy.
What did you say to him?
I said, listen to me, boy, sit down. This is Gogo's house. And the fact that your home, it might not look like Gogo's house, it does not make Gogo's house any less special. So, because all of us come from, so, and but you try to keep it as basic as possible. And I said, you should never, ever, ever, ever do that or say that again. And he apologized to his grand, and then life carried on. And we're also very clear that they predominantly speak Sesotho, also Zulu at home. Okay. And because I don't want kids going to the grandparents' home and say, well, I can't hear you, granny. What are you saying?
Yeah.
You know, so it's really trying to keep them as grounded as possible, because the times we're living in are very, you know, different times. So, and if you're not conscious as a parent to make sure that you're instilling that value system.
They slip away so quickly,
like,
right?
Before you know it. And once you still have them and they're still sponges under your roof, do the best that you can with them, because once they go into the world, they're gone.
Well, you've got all these other kids that well, let's call them your younger sisters, because they're these girls who you've invested huge time and effort into. And I'm not saying this because you told me or because anyone, I've heard it from them. I mean, Mini Dlamini and Bonang Mateva and some of these girls who didn't necessarily have the nuclear family you had when they were growing up. They didn't necessarily have the incredible experiences that you had in your 20s, but they've benefited from your experience because you share with them. You've been to family things with them. You've helped them out where you could. I mean, it was Pearl Tusi who said that you gave her her first laptop. You helped her bury her grandmother. You held her hand when she became a mom. You taught her lessons about being a lady. You scolded her when she faltered. You are an angel to her. Nobody talks like that about people that aren't their relatives. That's powerful stuff.
Gotta pay it forward, Gareth.
Yeah.
I call them children of my heart, daughters, hashtag daughters we raise. You know, when talent is born in this country, or at least it begins to step into the light, I think it's incumbent upon us, the older generation, to impart the little knowledge, perhaps, that we have about this game is hard.
Yeah.
It's brutal. Yeah. It's unkind. It eats young people alive.
Oh, hell yeah. We both know that.
Oh, hey.
Yeah.
And so if I've paid the school fees and I've burned my fingers and I've learned the hard lessons, why then should somebody else, a younger person who is a millennial, have to go through the same thing? Then it means that I have not done my part. I take this journey of I won't say mentoring, because I just think it's such a...
It's a bit cliched. A lot of people
cliche,
use it. Yeah.
Yeah. I take walking a journey of life with these young women very seriously. I mean, and it's not only just children in the creative space, in the arts. I mean, I have young people who are now judges, who are medical doctors, who are psychiatrists, who own architectural firms. And the university of life that I've been through, and there's probably, you know, many of them. I mean, Dr. Tsidi Gule, she wrote a book about me and how when she was at fourth, she was doing her fourth year medical degree. She was in Natal, and she was at a crossroad, not sure if she wanted to complete or not. But anyway, I said, you finished the degree. And she went on to qualify as a medical doctor. I was at her graduation. And I remember when I said, tell me what your future plans are, your vision. She wanted to start her own wellness institute. And I said, come with me with a business plan, present to me. And she did. And I was blown away by this child, and I invested in her business as when she started, and she's been running this business for the last 12 years successfully. So it's not only the young people that people see on television or read about in magazines, but it's children of this beautiful nation across the board who've chosen to walk different paths.
But it's so great that these people are able to tell you how much you mean to them while you're alive and while they're alive and while you can share in that, because it means it reinforces, right? And then they'll do the same thing one day.
And that's exactly what I tell them, that you paid forward. Mm. You look at whose hand you're going to hold as you journey on. I always say, especially with women in the corporate space, for example, when you've climbed the ladder, don't kick it down so somebody mustn't ascend. When you sit in that boardroom, don't you ever tell anybody that I am the only woman sitting in that board of such and such. What have you done to keep the door open for another woman to come and sit on the board? When I was the president of the Business Women's Association for 3 years, I was very clear that women have to open avenues for other women to come into the fold. I predominantly employ women, 99.99% of my staff in my production companies, in our travel business. It's in women. And so because we've had such a disadvantage through generations that, the face of poverty in the continent is a female face. Who has to walk miles to go and draw water? Who has to go and walk miles and find wood? Who has to sit by the bedside of a sick person? So if we have to change what women can and are potentially able to achieve, we have to economically emancipate them.
Absolutely. So, this is a known fact that emancipating women is the number one step towards civilizing an entire
economic
society.
emancipating them, because then we make better choices for ourselves.
And giving them the right to choose if they want to have children or if they don't, and when they want to have them.
Quite right.
That is the single thing that keeps women underfoot in most societies.
And in abusive relationships, where they cannot be able to make better decisions for their children, their bodies, and have to look for a blesser. Not under my watch.
Yeah. Well, your watch extends far and wide. Have you ever toyed with the idea? Because you certainly have huge influence. But have you ever toyed with the idea of real power, like political power?
It's not necessarily toying with the idea. I think it's a responsibility that some of us have. And that's why I then went to do a degree in politics.
Do you want to go for political office?
No, let me tell you, I have absolutely no lofty ideals for the higher office. However, I'm going to get involved in education. And work, because, Gareth, it can't be that in 2017, a child who gets 30%, it's acceptable. Mm-hmm. You've already purge them out of the system because they're never going to make it at UCT. They're never going to be able to even get in.
Well, the scary thing is even the person who qualifies at UCT won't be guaranteed a job.
Do you know what I mean? I want to be at a table where legislation, decisions, policies are formulated to give especially the black child an opportunity. Our kids who go to private schools, you know, they'll probably go study overseas. What does a child who lives in Kunu, what chance do they have to be able to go to UCT or to even Forte and be able to make a success of their lives? So we're perpetuating the cycle of poverty and we'll never be able to break it. So I'm going to get involved in education specifically. So I'm very crystal clear about what I'm going to be doing.
You sound like you are on a mission. I love it.
Listen, unapologetically so.
I am
on a mission.
Thank God someone is. Because sometimes you look around and you think, well, nobody seems to care about these kids.
I'm a teacher at heart, and I think obviously has a lot to do with
your mother,
my mother,
that's
my
what
sister.
You studied.
That's what I studied, and the fact that I never ended up in a conventional classroom with a chalk in hand and a chalkboard, I still am a teacher because I have a bigger classroom with what I do, with the content that I produce, that resonates with our people. So it's not a conventional classroom, but I have millions of students in this classroom. So I know for sure, if you ask me, Basitsana, in one sentence, what is your life purpose? I'm a teacher. And so the passion for education is what has propelled me, not to toy with the idea, but to know for sure that I need to get involved, roll up my sleeves and get into the trenches. Can't sit outside and be throwing stones. If you're not going to do anything, don't say anything.
I'm so happy we have you. I'm so excited about what the future holds for this country when we have people who are as adamant and determined to make it better every day, the way you are. And I know that you have represented a lot for a lot of people, but I'm thrilled when I look at you that you seem to be one of those people who's found her meaning, her purpose, her happiness. That's a great place to be.
It is well with me. It is well with me.
And that's why your cup overfloweth and you can pass it on, right? No, it really, it's true. I just see abundance for you.
Thank you. And everywhere. I receive that.
Love you lots, Bussy.
Love you too, my friend. It's been good hanging out. Thank you for having me.
This has been great. It's always nice to catch up. Love to the family.
Thanks, hey. Cheers.
Thank you.
Cheers, Garrett. Thank you.
This is CliffCentral.com.